dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Several weeks ago on the program, we played a talk by Professor Richard Heinberg dealing with the topic of peak oil and the role of dwindling oil resources behind the present so-called war on terrorism. Heinberg also spoke about the essential role that cheap and plentiful oil has played in creating modern industrial society, and the choices we'll face as a species in the immediate future due to the depletion of the world oil supply. This week we're going to go deeper in that direction. First, with the return of Richard Heinberg in a long interview that I encourage you to tape and distribute to everyone you can. Then we'll hear about the Dick Cheney energy policy and how the U.S. government has made the decision to respond to the coming oil pressures by making war to control the last drops. The interview we're about to hear with Professor Richard Heinberg was recorded right before the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Heinberg is the author of The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and his new book, Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World, will be released this July. The interviewer is British environmentalist and journalist Julian Darley from globalpublicmedia.com.
As an overture to the main drama of your book, your work, could you just say a couple of words about what oil peak is, more particularly for the layperson, because the more ways we have people encapsulating this, the better, because the different ways suit different people who are listening.
Very often when I talk to people about likelihood of oil shortages or price hikes in the future, they come back to me with a statement that, well, you know, I've read that we have another 50 years of oil or 70 years or whatever it is. And what they're really saying is that it'll be 50 years before we run out of oil. And actually, in fact, I think it'll probably be a lot longer than that. I would guess that a century from now there will still be oil in the ground and probably some way of pumping a bit out now and then. But the question of when we'll actually run out of oil is absolutely the wrong question to be asking. We should be asking, when will production peak? Back in the 1950s, M. King Hubbert, the petroleum geologist who worked for Shell and a bunch of other companies and taught at UCLA and MIT and a bunch of other universities, realized that for any given oil province, when about half the oil has been extracted, it becomes more difficult to extract what's left. And so the rate of extraction begins to taper off. The production peaks. And he reasoned that if that were true for East Texas or Oklahoma, it would probably be true for the United States as a whole. And he predicted that oil would peak in the U.S. The rate of production of oil, or the rate of extraction of oil, which is really what we're talking about, would peak in 1970. And at the time, everyone thought he was nuts, crazy. And events, of course, proved that he was absolutely correct. In fact, production of oil in the lower 48 U.S. did, in fact, peak in 1970, and it's been going down ever since. Up until the 1950s, the U.S. was extracting more oil than any other country in the world. We were not only the leading oil producer, we were also, for a long time, a leading oil exporter. But now we're at the point where the U.S. is importing 60% of what it uses. That's a result of oil depletion. We're past peak. We can't produce as much oil now per day or per year as we did back in 1970 when we were at peak. Now, what Hubbert and his followers like J.C. Campbell have pointed out is that discovery of oil, in the U.S. peaked in the 1930s. So there's this inevitable lag between the rate of discovery of oil and the rate and the peak in the rate of production. And of course, it makes perfectly obvious sense. I mean, you have to find oil before you can extract it. So what Campbell has done is extrapolated this Hubbert curve to the global situation. So when did, in fact, discovery of oil globally peak? This was a bit difficult to figure out because the reporting of reserves and discoveries is somewhat politically loaded. But once, and part of the problem is that it's sometimes the increases in the reserve figures appear on the books, and it's difficult to tell whether those are actually new discoveries or simply increases in the estimate of how much is in a province that was discovered, say, 20 years ago. So what Campbell had to do was backdate those reserve increases to the actual time of discovery so that he could figure out when the discovery rate peaked. And he found that the rate of discovery peaked in the 1960s, around 1964. So that being the case, it's not so difficult to figure out when the rate of production or the rate of extraction is likely to occur. And it turns out that that's probably somewhere in the range of 2006 to 2015, roughly speaking. So that's basically what we're talking about. We're talking about when is the rate of extraction going to peak. And that is the all-important date, not when is oil absolutely going to run out. When is the rate of extraction going to peak? Because why is that important? It's important because from that day onward, from that year onward, we will have less oil to go around each year from then on. In the U.S., after peak production, we solved the problem just by importing the oil from elsewhere. We saved our industrial economy, our industrial way of life, just by importing oil from other countries. But when the globe as a whole peaks in oil production, there's no place else to import it from. So then we get to the real problem, which is that we are tremendously dependent on this energy resource, hugely dependent. Our whole industrial way of life that we've built up over the 20th century is absolutely tied to oil and natural gas and to a somewhat lesser extent coal, which is also a non-renewable fossil fuel. And once these resources begin to be depleted, once the rates of extraction peak, then we have nowhere else to turn. We have to completely reorganize our way of life to do without them. And virtually no one is planning for that eventuality right now. It seems absolutely insane that that would be the case because, of course, anyone at a moment's thought would know that a non-renewable resource that you're using at a prodigious rate is going to run out. And so it perfectly makes sense to make other plans, you know, for what you're going to do when it actually does start to run out. But no one's done that. And that's the real tragedy of the time we're living in.
Well, that brings me to what is, in fact, your question number three. In your book, you discuss some of the critics of Colin Campbell and La Herrera and, well, Youngquist and all the rest of them, whom the critics call cornucopians. The critics are called cornucopians. You call them that, and various people call them that, and other things besides, flat earth economists and so forth. What are the arguments of these cornucopian critics? And perhaps you'd tell us what a cornucopian is, and why do you personally view their arguments as misguided?
Of course, the word cornucopian goes back to the mythical cornucopia, the horn of plenty, from which all good things emerged. And cornucopianism is actually not confined to just a few critics of Hubbert and Campbell and Lyrer and those people. Cornucopianism is the dominant ideology of our modern world. It's taught in every school of economics, and it's the subtext of every political speech, and virtually we're soaked in this point of view. The assumption is that the economy can grow forever, human population can grow forever, and will never actually meet up with any physical limits to the growth of our economy or our population. Now, again, a few moments' thought should point out the absolute absurdity of that way of thinking. But somehow it's weaseled its way into our dominant ideology, primarily through the field of economics. In economics, of course, we look not at resources per se. We look at how resources are mediated by money. And money, of course, is something that can be created infinitely, indefinitely. It's money is created through the making of loans, and banks create money all the time. So there's no physical limit in the amount of money that can be created. So economists assume that if there's enough money to go around, then the resources, well, if one resource actually starts to become scarce, we can just substitute another resource for it. It's the magic of the market that means the perpetual growth will be the order of the day for eternity. It's a very happy way of thinking. It's a way of thinking that says that, you know, just as our way of life is more opulent and fast-paced than our parents and grandparents, our children's way of life will be even more opulent and fast-paced, on and on to infinity. Of course, technological change has fed into this, too. We've, you know, developed all kinds of new technologies, generation after generation, from the radio to the television to the computer to cell phones and so on. And so if technology can continue to become more and more complex and effective and powerful and so on into the future, where's the limit to that? Where's the limit to human ingenuity? So these are the arguments of the cornucopians. And specifically with regard to the oil issue, the cornucopians say that, well, we just haven't looked in all the right places. Surely there's much more oil than we've discovered yet. And we can, of course, substitute other things for oil. We can substitute coal and natural gas. And when we run out of those, we can substitute wind and solar and hydrogen and so on. And some of them even say that, well, we're not running out at all, that if you look at the reserve figures, reserves of oil are growing in many cases, and we're developing new technologies to extract oil more efficiently so that, you know, in a particular oil well where using old technology we could only extract maybe 20 or 30% of the oil, now we have new ways of accessing maybe 40 or 50% of the oil from that same reservoir. So that should keep us going for decades longer until we figure out some real ultimate solution to the energy crisis, like fusion, for example, or some kind of exotic free energy device. This is all, again, you know, happy thinking. It puts a smiley face on our thoughts about the future. But when we actually get to looking at the real figures, it's not so simple. Looking, for example, at oil reserves and oil reserve growth, as Colin Campbell has done, looking at it closely, one discovers that much of the reserve growth that's been reported is actually political. Back in the 1980s, OPEC changed its rules to say that the amount of oil that it would permit countries to export would be based on the amount of reported reserves that those countries had. So countries were motivated to increase their reported reserves in order to increase their export quotas so they could make more money. Immediately when this rule was made, every country in OPEC reported dramatic increases in reserves, in some cases increases of up to 100%, when no new discoveries or few new discoveries actually had been made. These were purely hypothetical political reserve increases, and yet the cornucopians take them at face value as though all of that oil is actually there and waiting to be extracted. And the United States Geological Survey has bought into this way of thinking entirely, and I suspect that there's political motivation there as well. The USGS has been wrong consistently about future oil production, going back to the days of M. King Hubbert. They were a critic of Hubbert's curve from the very start. They failed to foresee the U.S. oil peak in 1970 and actually were taken to task by Congress for that. So there, the U.S. government's official cornucopianism has been pretty well debunked already in the past, and yet the USGS continues just to sail onward, predicting, you know, billions, trillions of barrels more of oil than probably actually exist.
Now I'd like to move on to one of your other questions, which you ask about some of the likely social consequences of oil depletion that you discuss. And I'm not sure whether that would be a moment to talk about net energy, which is a difficult concept for people, because unless people understand that there are some interesting and important kind of physics linkages between this oil depletion, that they will, as you've mentioned in your book, there are many concepts that people you just have to keep coming at them from 9 different directions, and this net energy one provides a lot of difficulty for people. So if you don't feel that's the moment to put it in, but
let's just talk about net energy per se, and then we can get into talking about the consequences of oil depletion. Net energy is one of the most important concepts for people to grasp if they're to understand our energy reality. It takes energy to produce energy, and this is true at every level from a bacterium on up. I mean, a bacterium has to expend energy in order to get a bit of food. Human beings have to expend energy in order to get their food energy. We have to expend energy in order to search for oil or coal or other energy resources. And the name of the game of survival is making the amount of energy you have to invest to get your energy less than the amount of energy that you ultimately harvest. If the amount of energy you have to spend to get your energy is greater than the amount of energy you eventually get, in biological world, you die. That's pretty much the end of the story. Well, when industrial societies discovered fossil fuels, and that's really what industrialism is all about, was the discovery of fossil fuels. When industrial societies began using fossil fuels, they had come upon a source of energy with an extremely high net profit. This was true for coal and spectacularly true for oil, particularly in the early days. I mean, you have to remember that oil in many reservoirs is under pressure. There's huge pools of this black, energy-dense liquid underground, and basically all one had to do was stick a pipe down there, and the oil under pressure would flow up through the pipe, and all you had to do then was find some way of getting it into barrels or tanks or pipelines to take it to where you wanted to use it or refine it. This was nature's free gift of energy that had been produced millions of years ago and stored through geological time. And the net profit on oil as a form of energy in those early days was way over 100 to 1. In other words, by expending one unit of energy in exploration and drilling and so on, one could reap 100 units, 200, 300 units of energy profit. Now, other sources of energy don't have such a spectacularly high energy profit ratio. In fact, virtually none of them do. And that's true of coal, it's true of nuclear energy, it's true of wind, solar, and all the rest. And in fact, oil itself has a variable net energy return, and its net energy return is being reduced year by year. Why is that happening? Well, the stuff that's easy to find, the stuff that's under high pressure, is the stuff that's being depleted first. It makes sense. I mean, if you're an oil company, you're going to look for the stuff that's cheapest to extract first. And only when that's gone are you going to want to invest in extracting the stuff that takes more time and energy and investment. So we have, at this point, extracted almost half of the oil that's going to be extracted economically, about 1 trillion barrels. And that first trillion barrels of oil that we've extracted is the easy stuff. It's the stuff that's easy to find, that's under high pressure, just have to stick a straw in the ground and it comes burbling up. What's left, the oil that's left, is going to be more costly to extract. So the net energy profit from that oil, instead of being, 100 to 1, 200 to 1, is going to be more in the order. It's already, oil exploration and extraction are already down to, by some figures, 20 to 1, 30 to 1, 40 to 1, in that range. And within the continental U.S., the activity of oil exploration has an energy profit ratio that by some estimates is down to about 1 to 1. In other words, it costs about as much energy to search for and extract a barrel of oil in the continental U.S. as that barrel of oil actually contains. So what this means is that the net energy available to industrial societies is being reduced year by year. Industrialism as a way of life, as a pattern of existence on this planet for human beings, succeeded because of this immensely huge energy profit ratio that existed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. That's what permitted us to build the vast infrastructure of agriculture and industrial production and transportation that we have now. It costs energy not just to grow that infrastructure, but also just to maintain it. And where is that energy going to come from? As not only as we reach petroleum extraction peak, but also as we pass, as we already have passed, the peak in the net profit from investment in energy resources. What we're headed toward inevitably is a much lower energy form of society. Industrial societies, if they're to survive, have to find a way of working on the basis of using vastly less energy per capita than we've become accustomed to. And whether they're up to that, whether it's actually possible for industrialism as a way of life to function in a much lower energy environment is an open question. I think that's actually the most important question that will be facing us during the next century.
Good. Thank you. I think that leads on to, in your book title, you say the fate of industrial societies, the fate of industrial societies sounds pretty ominous. What do you mean by that? And you can take that one separately, but my couple of little additions to that might be, during that answer, would you propose to mention what I call the pathological money system and its relation to the ideology of growth, and how might this cause a financial crash and monetary collapses, which I think you may be about to allude to? And you also mention that economies can crash when there is an expanding energy supply, as 1929 so carefully demonstrated. But is it possible, you ask in your book, for an economy to remain healthy through an energy crash? So you can take this how you like, and if you want to stop somewhere and have me re-prompt you, that's fine. But I just wanted to see whether you were going to tuck those into your basic question about the ominousness, if you like.
Right. So much here to unpack. I'll start, and then if I don't get to some of those points, we can come back to them. Theoretically, I believe that it's possible for industrial societies to convert to a much lower energy regime. It would be theoretically possible, for example, for the United States to divert hundreds of billions of dollars a year from investment in, say, weaponry, entertainment, sporting events, things like that, into production of windmills, into research, into new kinds of solar applications, and so on, into subsidizing, putting photovoltaic panels on the roof of every office building, every home in the United States. That's theoretically possible. And if that were to be done, it might be feasible for an industrial way of life, a different kind of industrial way of life than we're used to, certainly not the growth economy where we're constantly saturated in advertising images telling us to buy and consume more, and where we're surrounded with 20 kinds of any particular product, 20 different brands to buy, walk into the supermarket, and there are 50 different kinds of breakfast cereal and all that. That kind of industrial growth economy it will soon be a thing of the past in any case. But some version of industrial lifestyle could persist if we were to undertake a deliberate and coordinated process of transition that would inevitably involve a tremendous amount of sacrifice on the part of individuals and also large institutions. Now, the real tragedy of cornucopianism, the way of thinking that says that there's always going to be more and tomorrow is going to be a brighter day for the economy and new technologies will always come to the rescue and so on, the real tragedy of cornucopianism is that it's telling us that that kind of sacrifice is not necessary. that we're really not going to have to face at any point hard choices regarding resource depletion and population pressure. And so we're not, as a result of our cultural belief in the cornucopian ideology, we are unlikely to ever to undertake those kinds of coordinated efforts and deliberate sacrifices that will be necessary to make that transition. That's true because of the nature of our economic system, where money only exists because it's loaned into existence, and therefore every dollar or euro of money in existence carries a price tag in the form of compound interest, and which structurally requires economic growth in order to forestall an economic crash. It's also true because of our political system. No politician wants to stand up and say, look, folks, you know, we're in this horrendous fix. We've gotten ourselves out on a limb here with our industrial growth of the past and our use of non-renewable resources, and we're all going to have to tighten our belts. We're going to have to undertake a collective period of hard work and sacrifice in order to change our way of life, and we can't really expect, you know, more and better and more expensive and more diverse products and so on for our children. We're in fact going to have to perhaps even limit our population increase and reduce our population. We have to, in some ways, reduce aspects of personal choice. You know, what politician is going to stand up and say that? None. First of all, the people aren't going to vote for them, and second of all, the corporations aren't going to fund their election campaigns. So we have an economic system that's based on perpetual growth, not just ideologically, but structurally, because with compound interest being charged on all loans, and loans being the basis of the money supply, if without economic growth, the money supply collapses and the economy collapses. So we have an economy that's structurally based on perpetual growth and a political system in which no one is able to see the truth or name the truth, which is population pressure and resource depletion. And no one is able to stand up and say, look, this is what we have to do. So as a result of that, I think the likelihood of a collective conversion, a collective transition to a sustainable, lower energy way of life in the future is unfortunately extremely low. It's true, one politician has done this. Back in 1976, Jimmy Carter wrote the following words. He said, we must face the prospect of changing our basic ways of living. This change will either be made on our own initiative in a planned way or forced on us with chaos and suffering by the inexorable laws of nature. Those are probably the truest and most courageous words ever written by a sitting U.S. president. And yet we all know what happened to Jimmy Carter. And I think even today, probably Jimmy Carter would be hesitant to write or say anything quite as bluntly as he did back in 1976. The consequences are unfortunately pretty chilling to contemplate.
Did you want to say anything about whether you thought it was possible, or looking at the evidence? Because that's of course what's so interesting is not so much empty speculation. It's analysis based on evidence and speculation based on evidence. You said very interestingly, you made the comparison between economies that crash when there's expanding energy.
Right.
Do you want to say something about what we're facing, the opposite of that, and what you think the possibilities for that are?
Right. Well, in the 1930s, we had an economic crash even when there was still an abundance of labor, resources, raw materials. Everything that was actually needed to make an economy work was there. But because of overproduction, essentially, during the late 1920s, it was impossible to maintain the same rate of industrial expansion and therefore expansion in loans and economic activity and expansion in the money supply. The result was a sudden contraction in the money supply, deflation. And so people were thrown out of work and there was basically no money to buy anything with. Banks closed, mortgages were foreclosed, and so on. We're facing a similar situation today in regard to overproduction as we were in the 1920s. Just as in the 1920s, there was a bubble that had been created through investment in the new technology of radio. And, of course, the automobile had created the whole new realm of consumer indebtedness that had never existed before, consumer credit. We have a similar situation now in the early part of the century where consumer debt is at record levels and investment in the new technologies of the internet and high tech and so on have proven to be overly optimistic, shall we say. So bubble after bubble, real estate bubble, derivatives bubbles, all of these are beginning to deflate. And the likelihood is that just on the basis of the, as it's been called, the business cycle of inflation, deflation, investment, production, overproduction, and eventual crash, just on the basis of the conventional business cycle, we're due for a serious recession at this stage. But add to that the reality of the peak in oil and particularly right now natural gas production in North America. And the likelihood is that not only are we headed for an economic crash, but it's likely to be one from which there is no real sustained long-term recovery. Now, in some ways, an economic crash may be, it could be a good thing, at least theoretically. It's difficult to say how things will actually work out. But reduced economic activity means reduced demand. There's no money available with which to buy more stuff, and therefore less stuff is being produced, which means less energy is being used. So it's almost an enforced conservation program. This is part of what happened back in the 1970s after the first politically created energy crash in 1973 and then later 1979. The global economy went into a tailspin, and as a result, consumption of oil and other energy resources plummeted during the 1970s. And if you look at a graph of global oil extraction and consumption, it's this one long ramp upward until about 1973 when suddenly there is a dramatic drop-off. And it's because of that dramatic drop-off in oil extraction and consumption in the 1970s that we're sitting here today. Because if that hadn't occurred, global oil extraction peak would have probably occurred around 1990, 1995, instead of happening in 2006 to 2015. And we would all be sitting in the midst of a huge economic depression and other terrible consequences, so on. So basically, the economic downturn of the 1970s bought us time. Now, we haven't used that time very wisely. We've used it to, again, increase industrial production and resource extraction. But it's theoretically possible, if we have another major global recession, that we could buy ourselves the time to undertake, as I was saying earlier, a coordinated transition to much lower energy, renewable, sustainable economy. Again, the likelihood of that happening because of economic and political reasons is very low, but at least that possibility exists.
What's your view of hydrogen and other alternatives to fossil fuel, fossil fuels? Won't they be able to permit the survival of our industrial way of life? And I add to that, whether you want to tuck this in or whether you will put it in automatically, is what about futurists and then eco-futurists, you know, the Lovins lot and the eco-capitalist, the Hawkins lot and all that, and also what about, you know, nuclear and coal, because the futurists, of course, are wild about nuclear and coal. The eco-futurists are not so, but they'll throw fusion in there. And so there we are. So we've got hydrogen, and we're talking about the general topic there of substitution will save us, if you like. So if you want to set off on that one.
Yes. Well, recently, George Bush, in his State of the Union address, suggested investment in hydrogen as the fuel of the future. And I think this probably came as a surprise to many environmentalists because they had been proposing hydrogen as the fuel of the future, the hydrogen economy themselves. And I think Bush made a politically motivated effort to co-opt the issue, and perhaps successfully so. Of course, Bush was talking about making hydrogen from coal and nuclear electricity, whereas the eco-activists are talking about making hydrogen from wind or solar-produced electricity. But whether it's made from renewables or non-renewables, the question is hydrogen going to save us? And I think, I hate to say this, but I think it's extremely unlikely. Hydrogen is not an energy source. There are no hydrogen reserves sitting around beneath the soil or beneath the rocks that we can tap into the way we've tapped into oil. Hydrogen has to be made. Yes, it's often said that hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe. True enough. There's tons of hydrogen on the sun. There's tons of hydrogen in the methane on Jupiter. But it's not so easy to get at. Where hydrogen is most abundant, interestingly enough, is in fossil fuels. There's a lot of hydrogen in coal. There's a lot of hydrogen in gasoline. As a matter of fact, there's more hydrogen in a gallon of gasoline than there is in a gallon of liquid hydrogen. Go figure that out. But it's true. Why? Because when hydrogen is bound molecularly with carbon in hydrocarbons, it takes up less space. Free hydrogen is, even in its liquid form, is extremely diffuse. And that's one of the problems with transporting hydrogen and using hydrogen as a fuel. One of many problems, actually. But the main problem is simply that it takes more energy to produce hydrogen than the hydrogen itself has. It's always an energy loser. So if you're going to make hydrogen from natural gas, and by the way, virtually all commercially produced hydrogen right now is being made from natural gas, if you're going to make hydrogen from natural gas, well, you're going to lose energy in the process of converting the natural gas to hydrogen. And then when you convert the hydrogen to electricity or in a fuel cell, say, that process is also inefficient, so you lose some energy there as well. From a strict energy standpoint, you'd be much better off just taking the natural gas and using that directly. Similarly, with natural gas that you're making from hydrolysis using electricity, say from a photovoltaic panel to disassociate hydrogen from oxygen, from water, take some electric current from the solar panel, run it through water, and disassociate the oxygen from the hydrogen, then use the hydrogen to power a fuel cell and get electricity from that. Well, each stage along the way, you're losing energy. You're much better off from an energy standpoint simply plugging your photovoltaic panel directly into whatever it is you're trying to run. The only advantage of hydrogen is as a storage medium. That is its only advantage. And the only reason it could possibly be of use to us is if it's a more effective or efficient storage medium than, say, a battery. The best way to think of hydrogen is as a fancy battery. And in order for hydrogen to function as a very effective battery, it needs a huge infrastructure that we presently don't have. We need an infrastructure of storage. How do you store hydrogen in tanks? Well, it's difficult because the hydrogen atom it's the simplest atom. It has the characteristics of tending to make metals brittle. So if you have a metal storage tank, it's not going to last very long. And a certain percentage of the hydrogen is going to leak out of that of the tank, something like 2% per day, which is not negligible, of the hydrogen is going to leak through the walls of the tank every day. So there are a lot of technical problems that have to be solved in order for hydrogen to be of use in, say, powering automobiles. And do we have the necessary investment capital, and not just monetary, but also energy capital to get from here to hydrogen economy? I don't think so. And is there any cheese at the end of that tunnel? In any case, I seriously doubt it. Can we run airliners on hydrogen, conceivably very large ones, ones about three times the size of a 747 might be practical to run on hydrogen. And planes any smaller than that really aren't, because you have to have huge storage tanks. And with the ratio of the size of the aircraft to the size of the storage tanks, it really only makes sense with very large planes. Are we likely to design and build huge airliners three times the size of a 747 to run on hydrogen, given the fact that that hydrogen is likely to be extremely expensive, very unlikely, I think. I think the hydrogen economy is simply a non-starter. Now, what are other alternatives? Natural gas. Well, here in North America, natural gas extraction is peaking even as we speak, and we're seeing right now, we're talking in the latter part of February 2003, and we're seeing natural gas prices at historic highs as a result of depletion in the U.S. and Canada and Mexico. And it's very difficult to transport natural gas from continent to continent, even though there's a lot of it, say, in the Middle East, very difficult to transport that to the U.S. So natural gas is not going to be a good substitute for oil. Nuclear? Well, nuclear has very low net energy yield to start with. It costs a tremendous amount, not just in dollars, but also in resources, energy resources and materials, to build nuclear power plants and then to decommission them at the end of their lives. It's an extremely expensive process. And during their lifetime, they're producing nuclear waste, which we haven't figured out what to do with. Investing more in nuclear energy would be a huge mistake for industrial societies. We would be making problems for ourselves and our children and our children's children for hundreds of generations into the future, problems that I'm sure they would roundly curse us for, assuming they exist. Coal, there's a great deal of coal left to be mined, but the stuff that's easy to get at is becoming scarcer and scarcer. The net energy profit ratio on coal is declining rapidly. Right now, most of the easy to get at coal is surface coal from strip mining, and that's becoming more scarce. So what's left? Well, it's coal that's deep underground. And coal mining is not a particularly attractive profession to get into. Most coal miners would rather their children go into some other line of work. And it involves not only hard work, but also skill. And most of those skills have been lost. There aren't that many coal mines in operation these days because most coal is being strip mined. And so the skills, the equipment, and the motivation for mining coal from underground are fast disappearing in order to ramp up coal production dramatically to make up for peak in oil extraction. Again, would require not only investment, but also would entail huge environmental consequences. Coal is nasty, dirty stuff. There's just no getting around that. And the process of extracting coal ruins land, and the process of burning coal ruins air and water and forests through acid rain. It's a form of energy production that has already resulted in huge environmental costs. And the idea of ramping up coal production is pretty much anathema to anyone who has any knowledge and care about the natural world. So what are the other possibilities? Well, there are unconventional sorts of petroleum-like materials, tar sands, heavy oil, and the like. And there are potentially huge amounts there, but again, the net energy profit from those unconventional forms of petroleum-like materials, it's very, very low. For example, in Canada, about 200,000 barrels a day are being produced in Alberta of non-conventional oil. But it takes about 2 barrels of oil in energy investment to produce 3 barrels of oil equivalent from those resources. And again, the environmental costs are horrendous. The process uses a tremendous amount of fresh water and also natural gas, both of which are in limited supply. So it's unlikely that we'll see unconventional petroleum reserves making up for very much of the shortfall from conventional oil. And there are the really exotic things like fusion, in which tens of billions of dollars have already been invested. And the fusion researchers keep saying, well, we're 50 years away from really having a useful fusion reactor. And that's what they were saying about 25 years ago, and that's what they're still saying now. It keeps receding toward the horizon the further we go. So fusion is not likely to be of any help to us. And then there are people who talk about really exotic forms like cold fusion, zero-point energy, people who talk about the U.S. government having secret energy programs stolen from space aliens and so on. Who knows? Could be. I mean, the U.S. operates all kinds of black programs, off-the-books research programs, mostly into weaponry. Maybe they have something that they're not telling us, but the fact is exactly 0% of our commercially produced energy comes from all of these exotics put together, including fusion, cold fusion, and zero-point energy, and all the rest of them. Exactly zero is coming from those sources now. The idea that that we could somehow research them, develop them, and ramp them up to replace the immense amounts of energy we're getting right now from fossil fuels in any kind of foreseeable time frame is extraordinary wishful thinking. And I don't think we should be putting our eggs in that basket either. So at the end of the day, you know, once you've examined all of these alternatives, what you come up with is, or at least what I come up with, is essentially the recognition that the only solution to the depletion of oil, natural gas, and somewhat later coal is going to be simply using a lot less energy per capita and in total as industrial societies. Again, whether industrialism per se can persist in a much lower energy environment is an open question. I tend to doubt it, but it seems to me we really have no choice. We have to find a way of changing not only our energy infrastructure toward this much lower energy environment, making that coordinated transition, but also changing our economic system and our political system at the same time. It's a huge, huge undertaking. Are we up to it? Right now, I'd have to say no. The only real hope that I see is for the general public to become aware of the situation we're in. And that's really why I've written my book, and that's why I'm talking right now. I think the only hope is for us to bypass the conventional economic and political system and to spread this information as far and wide as we can among the general public so that the people themselves will be motivated to begin to undertake changes in their own personal lives and in their communities, essentially bypassing the conventional political system.
I think some of these deductions are virtually on the order of arithmetic, 2 + 2 = 4. And yet, of course, we, as somebody puts at the end of one of their emails that writes to me, 2 + 2 = 5 for very large values of 2. Which I think is cornucopianism written into a sort of Bertrand Russell language.
That's very good.
Should industrial societies adopt a no-growth economic policy as a response to the energy downturn?
Should they? Absolutely. Can they and will they? That is the real question. And the problem we actually talked about earlier when I was talking about where our money comes from and how it's tied to compound interest. If growth were merely an ideology, it would be so much easier to make this transition to a no-growth or actually a shrinking economy in terms of resource extraction and usage. But because of the nature of the money system that we have adopted, it's going to be very difficult to make that transition. That's why I think it's the kinds of alternatives that we need to adopt include not only alternatives in like solar panels and windmills, but alternative money, local currencies, and strategies for revitalizing and protecting local economies. Right now, the world is dominated by the dollar, dollar hegemony, it's called, for decades, actually, going back into the era of the Soviet Empire. Even people in Russia, when they wanted to keep the value of their savings, converted their rubles into dollars, and there are literally billions of dollars in coffee cans and under mattresses in Russia being kept as a store of value. And the dollar has been propped up for decades by this confidence that people have had worldwide in its value. It's also been propped up by the fact that the dollar is the currency of account for many nations. When nations borrow money from the World Bank, they borrow it in dollars and they have to pay it back in dollars. And when OPEC countries sell oil on the open market, they sell it for dollars. They expect to be paid in dollars. this has been a subtle subsidy to the U.S. economy that's been occurring for these past many decades. I think probably Richard Douthwaite, in his interview with you, I haven't had a chance to read or listen to it all, but I suspect that he touched on many of these points in it. So people who are listening to this interview might want to go check his out as well. This has been a subtle tithe, if you will, to the U.S. economy. Every time someone uses a dollar, it has to come from somewhere, and the only place it ultimately can come from is U.S. banks, because U.S. banks have a monopoly on the creation of dollars. So, and because each dollar originates as a loan, as a debt coming from a U.S. bank, it also is attached to the necessity of interest and compound interest being repaid at some time, therefore necessitating even more growth. Well, we're in a situation right now where there's increasing pressure around the world to switch from dollars as the currency of account to euros. This has already happened in the case of Iraq in November 2000. Iraq decided to cease accepting dollars for its oil and to accept euros instead. At the time, many financial analysts thought this was a really bad economic decision on the part of Iraq, and that they would lose tens of millions of dollars in value because of the switch from dollars to euros. In fact, it worked out just the other way. Iraq made tens or hundreds of millions of dollars just from its switch from dollars to euros, regardless of the amount of oil it was actually pumping. So now Venezuela, Iran, and even Saudi Arabia are talking about making a similar switch from dollars to euros. And as the New York Times reported a few weeks ago, people in Russia are starting to take the dollars out of their coffee cans and out from under their mattresses and exchange them for euros. More and more international trade is being denominated in euros as opposed to dollars. This spells big trouble for the U.S. economy. And I suspect that it has something to do with the Bush administration's insistence on invading Iraq. First of all, to teach Iraq a lesson for its abandonment of the dollar. Second, because Iran and Saudi Arabia, two other countries considering a switch from the dollar to the euro, are on either side of Iraq, and therefore establishing military bases there in Iraq would send a signal, as is often said these days, about the likely consequences of that action. I think we're in an extraordinarily delicate time right now from the standpoint of global geopolitics. There has been a relatively stable geopolitical situation in the world since World War II, really, through the Cold War, and even in the last 10 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. There's been a kind of Pax Americana administered by global corporations, mostly centered in the U.S., and with dollar hegemony as one of the main instruments of the maintenance of that stability. The other instrument for the maintenance of stability has been the U.S. military, which has been trotted out from time to time to, of course, to support the interests of U.S. corporations and so on, but also just to, in a sense, maintain the stability of the empire. Now, with one of those two props of the U.S. global empire being threatened, the dollar hegemony, I think the U.S. geopolitical strategists see that their only other strong card is the military, and that's why they're so anxious to play it right now in Iraq, to demonstrate that they still have that card and to frighten off any potential competitors and to insist that everyone still continue playing by the old rules of dollar hegemony. The rest of the world is not all that happy about the situation. I think it's pretty clear to most of the people who are actually in the know in other countries in the world that the U.S. is acting not out of a position of strength, but out of a position of great weakness. The U.S. economy is extremely weak right now and likely to become much more weak as a result of natural gas and oil depletion and increasing dependence on imports. So the U.S. is becoming much, much more dependent year after year upon other countries, and at the same time exerting more and more overt aggressive force against other countries in order to successfully maintain its position of dependency on one hand and control on the other. Not many countries are happy about that. So nations, particularly in Europe and Asia, France, Germany, Russia, China, Iran, are beginning to rethink their own future strategies and the possibility of some kind of economic alliance and also some sort of alliance in the allocation of resources is conceivable. If that were to take place, it would have pretty dire impact on the U.S. economy. And unfortunately, given the nature of the people in charge of the U.S. political structure right now, I think the likely U.S. response would not be a peaceful one. So, as I said, I think we're in an extremely delicate moment in the history of the world right now from the standpoint of geopolitics. And, of course, oil and oil depletion are right at the heart of this whole drama that's working out before our eyes. And one can only pray that somewhere there are cool heads that will prevail in all of this.
I don't think either of us thinks that's terribly likely at the moment. How does oil depletion figure into the current geopolitical scene? And obviously you've said quite a lot about that, so you might want to say you extend that somewhat. Do you think that Bush's determination to invade Iraq comes from a desire for oil profit?
Yeah. Well, let me answer that first and see what that triggers off. There are a lot of people on the political left who are calling this a war for oil, and there's certainly a lot of truth in that. But I think most of them have a rather simplistic view of the situation. They think that since Bush is an oil man and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and a lot of the people in the administration are former oil executives, that the real idea behind the invasion of Iraq is just to funnel profits to oil companies like ExxonMobil or maybe Halliburton. I really think that that's probably an extremely minor consideration, if it's a consideration at all, in these people's minds. And the reason I say that is that I think it's very unlikely that Iraq will be able to increase its production very significantly after military action. And if you look at what the oil companies themselves are saying, they're not all that excited about this prospect. Certainly, they're looking at who will get the spoils, but they're not exactly, you know, rubbing their hands with glee. And something similar happened with Afghanistan. You know, many people were saying, well, this was all about an oil pipeline. And in fact, after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, a pipeline was approved. But in fact, the oil companies haven't been all that excited about pursuing it. And it's really not happening at this point. The reason in Afghanistan was that it turned out that there was much less oil there than had been hoped for after some exploratory wells were drilled in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan and elsewhere. It was found that while there's a fair amount of natural gas there, the amount of oil is really much less than had been hoped. And so the pipelines are mostly languishing. In the case of Iraq, the oil production practices in Iraq have been largely destructive of the resource base. So even though there are something like 112 billion barrels of proven reserves under Iraqi sands, the likelihood of being able to increase rates of production significantly after military action is very low. It may be 5 to 10 years before rates of production can be increased past what they have been historically over the last, say, 10 years. So they're not huge profits there to be made. So what is the motivation? I mean, you know, the fact that we have to speculate about why this war is being planned is itself pretty remarkable. I mean, the arguments being put forward about weapons of mass destruction and so on are so patently flimsy that, you know, one has to speculate